We're going to talk about privacy, big data, security policy today. We'll be covering a lot of material, be laying out some confessions, some lessons, a prediction or two. We're going to have time for questions at the end. So this is usually a pretty engaging topic of how technology impacts our society. So compile them during the talk, and we should have quite a bit of time at the end to go through them. My name is Jim Adler. I'm, as Michael said, the VP of Products at Metanautics. Metanautics, just quickly give you a thumbnail of how and where we're emerging. We're about the next generation big data to really understand data supply chains within the enterprise and across enterprises, to really discover the data that you have and compute with it efficiently and easily. We're slowly emerging out of stealth mode. The company was founded almost a year ago, so stay tuned for a lot of more interesting things coming out of what we're doing at Metanautics. First confession, I am not an attorney. I'm an engineer. I have background in signal processing, cryptography, software. My undergrad was in electrical engineering, so I'm certainly more a geeky nerd than attorney, although policy really does intrigue me. I started early in my career designing advanced avionics systems for launch vehicles, did a stint of about 10 years developing online voting systems and the crypto protocols that are involved in that. That was an amazing ride. And now, most recently, I was the first chief privacy officer at Intellius, and also ran their big data team. So that's what I've been doing the last 4 or 5 years, which will be the crux of the talk. We'll be talking about what is the personal data supply chain. We were at Intellius at the end of that data supply chain. We had about 20 billion public records. We saw about 30 million visitors a month. The company's been around since 2003. The company over the lifetime has sold about 50 million reports. They power. It's been only a few months since I left. People search for AT&T, previously for Yahoo. So usually if you're looking for someone online, if they don't have a very common name, you can get away with a Google search. If they have a name that's a little more common, you're going to find yourself at Intellius or one of their properties. You know, people ask me, well, why did I join Intellius? They were a data broker, which is usually a derisive term. When I joined, they had a Better Business Bureau rating of an F. They were engaged in several investigations by attorneys general across the country. The Senate Commerce Committee was investigating them. I had to be either stupid or naive to jump into that. But what I really found, I really thought, was that public data is an important element of establishing trust between people. And I felt there was a need to do it right. And I thought I could do more from the inside of an organization like that than just throwing rocks at them from the outside. So during my tenure, we improved our Better Business Bureau rating from an F to now a B+. I'm proud of that. The investigations are over. We've established the industry as something that is reputable and trustworthy, at least in some eyes. But I didn't do that alone, far from it. When I first joined Intellius, I did a privacy listening tour of our toughest critics. Actually, it was a much more modest tour. We looked at people that were really at risk for the kind of data that we provided. And at-risk groups included folks like victims of domestic violence and elected officials and police officers and judges. Those were the folks that were often the subjects of stalking, and offenders would use our data sometimes for those ill-gotten or ill purposes. So I went to talk to some of these folks. The first on my list was the National Network 10 Domestic Violence. Victims of domestic violence are typically stalked, typically women, and I really wanted to understand what we could do as a provider of personal information to these women. And so I went to talk to Cindy Southworth, who's an executive at the National Network 10 Domestic Violence, and I said, Cindy, what can we do better here? And she was pretty straightforward, get my women out of your data. And I think that was a pretty clear directive. And I said, great, give me the list. There's about 50,000 women in the United States that are victims of domestic violence. We give us the list and they're out. And she went and tried to go compile the list. And she came back and said, you know, Jim, these women, they don't, really don't like to be on any lists. I mean, that's the last thing they want to be on is on a list. And I said, okay, how about we give them a PIN and they could log in to opt out their record? And that kind of, she kind of shopped that for a bit, and she came back and she said, you know what would really be helpful? Why can't these women just suppress their latest contact information? They don't want to opt out their entire profile. I'm like, why? Because offenders will know that the women are proactively managing their profile and incense them even more. Will incent the offender even more. And so what would be nice if the trail just ran cold? Most safety-sensitive information is the contact information. Can you just wipe that out? I thought that was a great idea. And I thought it was not just a good idea for at-risk groups, I thought it was a good idea for our customers. And so I really started to cook this idea that wouldn't it be nice to be able to have access to your own background check and be able to manage the privacy profile around your own background check. And I started to think about this more deeply, and then I talked to another privacy advocate, one by the name of Sally Applin, and she's an anthropologist and a product designer. She designed Go-Gurts years ago because they look like bananas, and so kids, you know, they love bananas, so she put yogurt in something that looked like a banana, and of course Go-Gurts are a huge hit for, I know they were for our boys, they love Go-Gurts. And so I asked Sally, what do you think of you know, our product, and what can we, same questions I asked Cindy, and she said, you know the problem with Intellius? You guys are all about voyeurism and not enough about narcissism. I'm like, yeah, I think you're right. And it's the same note that Cindy echoed. Show me my own background check. And so we did. There's a site now called truerep.com. It's a free site. You can look at your own background check after you're appropriately authenticated through a knowledge-based authentication. You can execute privacy controls on that site. You can suppress your latest contact information. You can also do something that no one in the domestic violence community or at-risk group or privacy community asked for, but I thought was a really interesting idea that came from a buddy of mine. When I started at Intellius, he looked up his background check and he had a criminal charge on his record, and the charge was criminal trespassing. And he said, Jim, there's a criminal trespassing offense on my record. All I did was jump the fence at a concert in college. It sounds like I broke into a house. Can't you change it? I said, well, that's how the county reports it. We don't change it. We can't change it. What would we change it to? Well, why can't you at least let me comment on it and provide my side of the story so if someone sees that record, they will know my side of the story. I said, that's a good idea. We could do that. And so this site lets you do that too. So you can actually comment. So anyone that pulls your background check will actually see your comment right next to any charges. So I think this is maybe a little ahead of its time. I think there's going to be more and more access to your own information and the ability to manage it effectively. It's public information, but you should have a voice in it so that it's perceived correctly. And I think it's your responsibility to manage, and you're right, to manage your own public data. So popping up a level and sort of looking at data generally, not a big surprise, there's a lot of it. Between the time, and I know some of you may know this, from the time that the first cave people drew on walls till about 2002, there's 20 exabytes of data transferred, created, stored, moved around, that kind of thing. Four times that was moved around, created, stored in February of this year. February is a short month, so probably more than that. Part of this stacklet of data, one of these stacklets of data was personal data, and this is the public data supply chain that we were privy to at Intellius, and this is sort of where the data comes from and where it goes. It comes from three sources predominantly. The headwaters of this supply chain are the government, typically vital records, property records, licenses, things like that. There's commercial records, which come from businesses, probably businesses that you actually do business with. So when you get that really inexpensive oil change and you sign the documents when you pay for it, you may be signing away the data that you provided that oil change company, and it'll be sold into this data supply chain. The last element of this is self-reported data, data that you put up in blogs, that you might put in other public fora, Twitter, Facebook, if your privacy settings aren't clamped down. So there's a lot of data. There's a kind of a list of the data that's in that comes into this data supply chain. And then it gets crunched together through these big data engines. And then it's used for a bunch of stuff. In the risk environment, it's used for credit reports and credit checks, housing, employment, screening, marketing, behavioral targeting feeds this, is fed by this data supply chain. Deep background checks, as well as directories that Intellius engaged in. And people ask, what uses do people have for this data? Most of them are not regulated. Some of them are regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, but most of these are not regulated. They run from the mundane to the obscure. Someone's putting together a reunion and they want to pull together addresses of people that they went to school with. Love is actually a big use for consumer background checks, checking out a date. Parents checking out a fiance is a big use. There's some profound uses. People, adopted kids looking up their birth parents is a common use. The one that is the most obscure, I think, is in sort of 3 o'clock. It's find owner of dog's relative for transplant. This actually was a use of an analyst that worked for me. And we always, when our analysts interviewed with us, we always have them look at our site and give them a critique, or they would give us a presentation of what they found with the site. And she came in and said, you know, I used the site a couple years ago. My dog needed a bone marrow transplant, so we needed to find my dog's sibling. So we had to find the owner of my dog's sibling, and we used Intellius to do that. I'm like, wow, that is one creative use of our service. So lots of uses. Let's talk a little bit about how we do all this. How do we do this linkage? How do we accomplish this linkage problem? We take billions of records, about 15 billion records or so, and this is in the United States, typically, a little Canada. And we have to take those billions of records and we have to match them to the hundreds of millions of people in the United States. And so a lot of people have the same names, clearly. Carol Brooks, for example, there's about 1,300 people named Carol Brooks in the United States, and we might have about 10,000 records for people named Carol Brooks, and we have to find the right Carol Brooks records for the correct Carol Brooks people. For me, there's about 200 records for the 35 or so Jim Adlers in the country. And so we do this record linkage problem, and what comes out of it is a cluster of records. So you see at the bottom right, there's these cluster of records, and you see the Jim Adler about 10 o'clock. That's an ambulance-chasing lawyer from Houston, Texas, who is the bane of my online existence because he really punches records out there, and he always shows up higher than me in Google, and I'm the lame Jim Adler at about 8 o'clock from now Mountain View, California. So these are all. This is the cluster of all the Jim Adlers that exist. And so these are available for purchase at places like Intellius and other sites where you can get these profiles. We also offer opt-out. So you can opt out, not just suppression of your latest contact information, but for free, you can opt out a profile. And people ask, when someone opts out, do you delete the record, delete the profile? Confession, no, we do not. And there's something called the Fair Information Practice Principles that talk about data minimization and minimal use and things like that, fair use of data. And people ask, why don't you delete the data? Because we feel that we certainly suppress it. We certainly honor the opt-outs. We'd be in big trouble with the Federal Trade Commission if we didn't honor the opt-outs. But sometimes we can do better by not totally erasing the data. And here's an example. So here's two records. Here's a profile with two records, a Jane Hampton from Peoria, Illinois. We have two records for her. One has her date of birth. She's about just turned 15 years old. She's a minor. Now, you might ask, why do you have minor data in your information cache at all? Sometimes it gets in there. As much as we don't want data on minors, sometimes it gets into this data supply chain, and we don't know where it comes from. We are voracious, or Intellius is, and other data brokers are voracious acquirers of data, and sometimes data from minors gets in there. And so we put it together. We put these two records together. One record has the date of birth. The other record does not have the date of birth, and we link them through our linkage engine. And then we would opt it out because we don't serve profiles on minors. So then if we did follow the data minimization principle of FIPS, the Fair Information Practice Principles, we would then erase this profile. But what if we got another record the next month, but it had no date of birth on it? It was as Jane Hampton, and there's her email address. If we had totally erased the opted out profile, we'd have nothing to match it against. We wouldn't know that Jane Hampton is a minor, and we would end up serving this profile with her email address. However, if we kept it, we would now have two records in a profile for a minor, and the new record would snap into that profile because we'd be able to match it at least by email, and now we could opt out the entire profile. And now no information on Jane Hampton, the minor, would actually leak out onto the site. So I think sometimes there are reasons why if you follow the letter of some of these principles, you end up delivering poor service. And I think that's where a little innovation, a little thoughtful, objective reasoning comes into play. So that's a little bit of detail on the personal data supply chain. Let's get some altitude on the history of this, at least how I've been thinking about it for a while. A while ago, 150 years ago or so, towns were pretty small. I love this Oscar Wilde quote, "The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about." And this is a painting by Norman Rockwell called The Gossip. And I spent about a couple years of my youth in Greensboro, Alabama. And I think the population now is 2,500. I think when I was there, the population was like 1,200. And the town is small, and everybody knew everybody else. And when you cut school, the whole town knows by dinner, literally dinner, that you cut school. There was the reasonable expectation of privacy, which is actually a legal term, was very low. A friend of mine, Ralph Monroe, who was Secretary of State in Washington for a lot of years, he grew up on Bainbridge Island, and they had a party line down at the harbor, the only phone line. This is, I think, in the 40s. And everybody was listening, always listened to the party line, a telephone from Bainbridge Island. There was no expectation of privacy. It was a different time. Through the 19th century, urban populations grew along with anonymity, and you ended up with a rising of expectation of privacy, something I try to capture in this sort of notional diagram, where you had this sort of Rockwell era, where urban densities were low, personal anonymity was low, and then you had this with the Industrial Revolution through the 19th century, you had this sort of march higher in urban density and anonymity, what I'd call the good fences era. And then around 30 years ago, you had this sort of what I'm calling the privacy vertigo era, which is where you had online density sort of drop really fast, and personal anonymity dropped really fast, and these big data supply chains started to just pull the rug out and the floor out from underneath us, and everyone is getting their 15 minutes of fame, and others are just getting completely freaked out by this level of exposure. There are incredible advances around personalized medicines and communications and energy, great things coming out of this. One thing that I thought is really interesting, how time and space is shrinking here. I grew up in Miami, Florida. I haven't been back. I haven't lived there in probably 35 years. I get a Facebook friend request from a buddy from high school, out of the blue. And this was a few years ago. And so across 35 years and 3,000 miles, I get this friend request. And he was a good buddy, kind of a roughneck kind of kid. Certain parts of Miami are less savory than others. And I really, you know, I had my kids on there, on the site, my family, all the pictures, and I'm like, should I really accept this friend request from this guy? So what do you think I did? I background checked him, because I could. And he had priors, actually, but nothing violent, nothing violent. So I said, well, okay, you know, he had a rough time in the 90s. He got married, had a kid, kind of cleaned his act up. Yeah, a little drug trafficking. Okay, what are you going to do? It is the 90s. So I accepted his friendship, and it's been fine. And no ill, no cautionary tales to tell. But I think this level of information, it's all public record, it's public information. It let me make an empathetic decision about someone's life and whether to include them in mine. And I think that's a new world. There's no physical proximity there, or even temporal proximity. So it's fascinating. And when you look at privacy from the context of culture and history, it's really interesting. And one of the things it's interesting to look at is sort of this EU versus US privacy model. It's deeply cultural. In the United States, we value disclosure above discretion. Values of speech and press and assembly are really values of disclosure, where the European Union really values discretion more than disclosure. They value privacy and due process and equal protection. Not that we don't. It's an issue of balance. The EU views us as somewhat reckless, and we view them as somewhat conservative and stodgy. Reminds me of that George Carlin quote that, you ever notice everyone driving faster than you is a maniac and everyone driving slower than you is an idiot? I think that's what the EU views us as maniacs and we view them as idiots. And I don't think anybody's right here. I think it's just where you sit, where you stand, everyone who's not like you or doesn't think like you is wrong in some sense. And I don't think that's true at all. I think it's just we're just grappling with these values that are in tension. And they come from an interesting background. The EU has this inviolable right of dignity, this right of personality, that dates back from the 1900s. It was really solidified after World War II and the Nazi abuses. The right of personality really came to embrace privacy rights. In the US in 1890, Brandeis and Warren created their infamous right to be let alone doctrine. And so that really is all-encompassing privacy doctrine. Whereas in the US, we're really about harms, especially with respect to individuals and corporations, everything except government and citizen, which obviously have Fourth Amendment privacy protections. Between people and corporations, it's really about harm. And in 1960, Prosser put out these torts, and there's four of them. It's pretty straightforward. There's the peeping tort: don't look at private information or private. Don't violate anyone's private space. Don't assume anybody's identity. Don't blab. Don't blab private facts. And don't slander anyone. The United States privacy regime is pretty much built on those four torts. And there's a set of sectoral privacy law that goes with those torts. Things around, like, there's healthcare privacy, and there is financial privacy, and there's employment privacy. There's no overarching privacy, which really makes it difficult in the United States to figure out when does privacy matter and when doesn't it, especially when you're designing products. And so I came up with this thing, like, I got to unpack this thing, because, like, when I was at Intellius, my guys would always come with these great ideas they thought were great ideas. How about we let people search by picture? You take a picture of somebody, and then you can immediately see their background check. And I'm like, oh God, that's awful. We'll be all over the press in not a good way. But what I wanted to do is figure out, how do we tease this apart so that this becomes actionable? And there's sort of three axes that privacy turns on. At least for this formulation, it's places, players, and perils, I call it. The places are, is it a private place or a public place? I think that's an important axis. There's a story of me leaving a Mariners game a couple years back, and we're going up the ramp, and this girl is like taking pictures of everybody coming up the ramp. And I was with somebody, because I'm a privacy guy, so people say, is that a violation of privacy, Jim? And I said, well, not really. I'm in a public place. I could expect that picture would be, there'd be facial recognition of me, and it would be uploaded on Facebook, and everybody would know I'm at the game. Well, how different is that from 150 years ago when the town might have saw Jim at the game? Not a whole lot of difference. So it's important to understand when you're in public and when you're in private. And sometimes it's hard to tell, which we'll look at in a minute. The second axis is players. Are these powerful players, or is there a big power difference between the players, like a citizen and a government, or are they peers? And then fundamentally, what can go wrong? I think that is a big issue. What are the perils? The players' disparity, actually, Bruce Schneier came up with that a few years ago, that privacy is really about equalizing power, and I think that it was a brilliant insight. Looking just a couple examples around this, if you look at the places, hey, sometimes you're in a public place when you think you're in a private place. There was a 2009 study by MIT called the GADAR Project, where they were able to discern someone's sexual orientation by just their friends on Facebook, even if their privacy settings were clamped down. And Hal Abelson, who's a professor there, said, hey, it's no point in having control of your information because it's all out there anyway. And I think he makes a point. There are things that people are going to derive from public data that is private. And I think that is a really important issue that we're going to talk about in a little bit. Here's one that I really love. Behavioral targeting. I don't know how many Twilight Zone fans we have. I figured this audience, we gotta have some Twilight Zone fans. If you look at social media, services on the web, we're either paying with our money or we're paying with our data. I did this post a couple years ago called Your Privacy is Worth $5 a Month. And the way I came up with $5 a month is I just looked at Facebook's market cap, what their user base is, what the investor expectation on return would be, and I kind of backed out $5 a month. It's actually much less than that because the market is valuing Facebook's revenues quite a bit higher. So it's maybe $1 a month. But the fact is, you're either going to pay with your data, you're going to pay with your money. And I proposed at that time, 2.5 years ago, that Facebook should have a tracker charge option. You either pay them you pay them $1 a month, or they can use your data however they like. Someone's got to pay for the service. There's no free lunch here. Actually, Biz Stone, the founder from Twitter, came up with a similar proposal a few months back. But I do think that at the end of the day, we got to figure out how to charge for these products. Sure, we love the service, but if we're not careful, we're going to be on the menu. Talk about power a little bit. I alluded to this a little bit. This is this notional graph of privacy rights versus power disparity. So peer-to-peer, there's not much privacy. There are not that many privacy rights. Between a corporation and a customer or an employee, there are certainly statutory protections. Section 5 of the FTC Act says that corporations certainly can't be unfair, act unfairly, or deceive. The Fair Credit Reporting Act says that there's certain procedures a company must go through when they're doing a background check on a prospective employee. Between government and citizen, there's constitutional protections. And between you and your God, none. An example of this was like Target. You remember the Target? Anybody remember the Target knows you're pregnant? This was pretty interesting. It's a very simple machine learning problem because women had baby registries. So they would say, hey, I'm pregnant. And people would register to get their baby stuff. And they would see what those customers who were registered for baby showers, what they bought. So they were able to build up some training data around what pregnant women purchased. And then they extrapolated that to the rest of their customer base. The challenge is they really didn't think about the power implications of that because there was a teen mom who started to get coupons in the mail saying, hey, we know you're pregnant. Come buy unscented lotions or, I don't know, bedding. And the father of this teen called Target and said, my daughter's not pregnant. Until the daughter said, yeah, daddy, I am pregnant. And that was there is a power disparity between parents and children. And that really wasn't respected by Target. And that's only one abuse of power. Consider that if an employer knew ahead of time that their employee was pregnant, might they not give them certain assignments? Might they not promote them? Insurance might be delivered at a more expensive rate. So people in powerful positions can exploit this information. And this is only one of two equations in the deck. There is a correlation between the difference in power between players and the secrets they keep. And I actually use this when I look at teams and whether how much they trust each other and trust me or trust their leaders. If they have a lot of secrets, there's not a lot of trust. And you can use this as a signal. Like if you sense there's secrets running around the team, that means there's not a lot of trust, and that's not a good thing for productivity of teams. I wrote this post a while back, why employees lie. And they lie because it's the boss's fault. The boss is in a position of some power. If they can't engender trust with the team is going to do whatever they can, typically lie, because lie levels the power playing field. That's what they have to do. There should be no shame in that, because that's what weaker players need to do to level things out. So putting this all together, this places, players, perils, cases, if you look on the vertical, more powerful players are on the vertical, more private places are on the horizontal, and on the right are the most private places, and on the left are the more public places, and powerful players on the top and weaker players on the bottom. And then you could do things like take cases that show up in the press and plot them on a graph like this. And the sphere, the size of the sphere is how perilous the outcome could be. So I took a few, and I sort of collect these as a hobby. These are only like, I have probably 50 or 60 of them, but it would make the chart even noisier than it is right now. So let's walk through just a couple of these. So there was a case where the US deported a bunch of Brits because they tweeted that they're going to destroy America. And really what they meant was just going to party really hard. And so the TSA saw that and deported them. And so certainly public data, but in a very powerful player can really exploit that. And deportation is a major deal. I mean, incarceration, execution, deportation, those are things that only governments can do. There was a case of Ashley Payne in Georgia where she posted pictures of her vacation. Sort of, she was in Ireland, she was drinking Guinness or something. She shared those on Facebook, and somehow the school board got wind of those pictures, and they fired her for drinking. This is an interesting case, because Ashley Payne said, I felt violated, like someone stole the pictures out of my house. I think she got that part wrong. It's not that no one stole the pictures. She shared the pictures, and sharing is this sort of gateway drug between private and public. It's sort of this slippery slope. You share something, and then all of a sudden it's out there. The abuse happened by the school board. Unless your contract said you cannot drink at all while you're under contract, whether it's on our time or yours, the school board abused that information. I know she had filed suit. I don't know how the suit came out, but it's clear that was a clear abuse of information, not an inappropriate access of information. I like this one too. The FBI put a GPS transmitter on Antoine Jones' car. He was a drug kingpin in Maryland. They had him dead to rights. He was a drug kingpin, and he was convicted. But the FBI put the GPS transmitter on his car without a search warrant, tailed him for a month, and obviously all that information clearly showed he was guilty. This case went to the Supreme Court. This Supreme Court voted 9-0. They don't vote 9-0 on anything. That this was inappropriate search, violation of Antoine Jones' Fourth Amendment. They vacated the conviction. Clearly a private place. But before this case, not so clearly, because your house is clearly private, but is your car private? And the judges ruled that your car actually is a private place, which I think was a victory for privacy advocates. But then something on the peer side of the spectrum, if you remember Tyler Clementi, a webcam captured him having sex, and he ended up committing suicide due to the public shame of it. And so it isn't just large power disparities that end in perilous outcomes. Sometimes a violation of privacy, even by peers, can end in perilous outcomes. So it's important to understand this sort of framework and figure out, if you're designing products, certainly where does your product land on this? And if you're doing an analysis, what's important? Who are the players? What is the space where you're gathering the data, and what potentially could go wrong? So now I want to switch away from the policy for a second and talk about technology a little bit. There's a lot of data out there. This is a study I did for a Strata talk I did earlier this year. Actually, this one was last fall. And I wanted to sort of understand what, if we wanted to take the capacity of a human brain and rent it at Amazon, what would that cost? And so Chris Westbury, University of Alberta prof, sort of guessed and that the human brain has 20,000 teraflops of compute capacity and 2.5 petabytes of storage, and he didn't estimate I/O or network. But if you were just to buy that at Amazon, it would cost you $27 million a month today. However, the good news is, in 20 years, that'll cost you less than $700,000 a year, about $53,000 a month. Which, and the reason I kind of did this analysis was, we're doing all these inferences outside of our own brain. We're making inferences outside of being in the same room as someone. For example, when someone comes in and interviews for a job, you know, you can guess their age, you can guess their gender, you can guess their race. So you're thinking all of this stuff, and usually that's okay. Of course you know. You know what, if they're showing, you know they're pregnant. If you act on those sorts of things, you have a problem. And so now the next question is, well, if a big data engine somewhere is making some inferences, should that be allowed, even if those inferences are like way creepy and very objectionable? Should that big data engine still be able to derive those inferences? So this was motivated by a friend of mine, Daniel Tunkelang, who's he's the head of search at LinkedIn, and I was on a panel with some privacy advocates, and we were talking about deriving private facts from public data. And Daniel raised a hand, and he said, you know, if you can't derive private facts from public data, it sounds like you guys are trying to define a new category of thought crime. And that just seems wrong. And that was a really good question. And the privacy advocates and I, we all looked at ourselves and were like, yeah, that's a really good question. I got to go think about that. And so I did. And so I went back to the source of thought crime, George Orwell, and said, the problem with thought crime and the reason it feels bad is because everything else leads from thought. And 2,600 years ago, Lao Tzu said the same thing. Thoughts become words, words become actions, actions become habits, habits become character, your character becomes your destiny. Everything starts with thought. If you could stop thought, you can stop all these bad things. You might stop a few good things too, though. So if you look at thought and speech and action, we know that actions often are criminal. Sometimes speech is actually criminal. In the case of libel or slander, like we talked about with Prosser's torts. Conflict with a legitimate interest. I think Ed Snowden is having trouble with publishing things he shouldn't have published. But thoughts generally are not crimes. except in the case, the really weird aberrant case of conspiracy theory or conspiracy crimes. And usually that comes out of society's sort of existential response to a threat that is sort of beyond them. And you see conspiracy crimes around organized crime and terrorism, typically. But anything else, at every other time, conspiracy is not a crime. So that, this was sort of the ideology around, hey, is thought crime a real crime or not? Can big data engines do inferences? The conclusion is, yes, of course, big data engines can perform thought. So that was the theory of it. So then I decided to really test this theory and design a felon classifier because we had all this great criminal data in Intellius. And I said, hey, well, let's kind of push on this a little bit and say, well, okay, thought isn't a crime. What if I try to predict or figure out if someone's a felon or not based on criminal data? So there's actually a piece in today's Bloomberg News on this felon classifier. There's the link. That talks to this in some detail, but I'll go through it a little bit with you. And in Intellius, we have criminal data for everybody in the United States, 250 million defendants, which if you think about that number for a minute, you know that's got to be wrong, because there's not 250 million people with a criminal record in the United States. There's a lot of duplication of that data. Usually that data is crunched down to about 40 million defendants in the United States. And then what we did during this exercise is we crunched it, we cleansed the data, we linked the data, then we sampled the state. We took Kentucky. Not to pick on Kentucky, but it was a small enough data set that we could release it. This data is up now at GitHub under iNome. iNome is the big data engine that powers Intellius, so you can go to GitHub and check out, pull down the data. And we defined some features and trained a learner. And so here's how the learner works. It's an alternating decision tree. Here's a few of the features, gender, eye color, how many tattoos, how many criminal offenses they had and what type they were. And so as you walk down this, there's two records here, one male, one female. And this was all trained on this Kentucky data. And so if you're a female with hazel eyes and two more or more tattoos and you have four or fewer misdemeanors, you start adding up these scores for each feature, and you end up with 4.4, and it's above a threshold of 3.5, which makes a binary decision of whether you're a felon or not. The top record doesn't have a high enough score to be classified as a felon. So you can actually check this out. I have a widget actually on my blog where you can actually go you can actually answer the questions, and it'll decide whether you look like a felon, or at least look like a felon if you live in Kentucky. So at some point, the technology ends and the policy begins. And this is why I wanted to kind of take that departure toward technology and then come back to policy. So this is a false negative versus false positive curve that defines the performance of the classifier. And so that line is the performance of the classifier based on what threshold you want to choose. And the best classifier would be that line would go through the origin, because that's where you would have no false positives and you'd have no false negatives. Evidently and obviously, our classifier sucks much worse than the ideal classifier. But if you look at the extremes here, they tell you a lot, because you have to pick a threshold. In the previous slide, we picked a threshold of 3.5. In this country, you're innocent until proven guilty, so you want the classifier to not be that aggressive. Because if you're very aggressive, or aggressive at all, you start to bring in or classify people as felons that are not felons. For example, if you look at the far right there, the false positive rate is 19%. Yeah, you don't miss any felons. Your false negative rate is zero, but 19% of the people you classify as felons are not felons. Not cool. Although, if you're a tyrant, it's cool. So there's sort of this anarchy-tyranny trade-off when you're doing a policy determination on where the threshold should be. If you want to swing toward the anarchy side, I think the most lenient spot on this curve is 91% false negatives, so you only catch 9% of the actual felons, but you don't misidentify anybody. So it's Thunderdome, right? No one is a felon. And so policymakers have to choose where you want to be on this curve. Because this is effectively, and other technologies like it, are computerized informants or computerized tipsters. And if you don't couple good policy with this kind of technology, you're going to have problems. The first place you're going to have problems is in court. Because reasonable suspicion and probable cause is usually our mechanism for vetting out bad police work. However, states, courts have upheld profiling. There was a case of U.S. v. Sokolow where this guy comes in from Hawaii to Tampa, two-day ticket, paid cash, used an assumed name. They profiled him. This guy looks like a drug trafficker, and sure enough, he was, and the ruling was upheld. But this predictive information can't live all alone by itself. It has to actually be corroborated with other information. It has to be particularized, has to be efficient to get. And I think most importantly, it needs to be detailed enough so that it doesn't identify everybody. It identifies just the target. And I think that's important based on, and there's more, you can look at more references there. Just on Monday, I don't know if you guys saw the news, New York City's stop and frisk was ruled unconstitutional. They've been doing this for about 10 years. 600% increase in stop and frisk over the last decade. Just in 2011, 684,000 people were stopped and frisked. So this is a quote from the judge. And she said, the city believes that blacks and Hispanics should be stopped at the same rate as a proportion of the local criminal suspect population. So that sounded like a Bayes rule problem to me. And I said, okay, well, let me push on this a little bit and see, and I don't know, for those that are unfamiliar with Bayes rule, it basically says that can you adjust a probability based on a general statistic to something that uses some given additional information. So in this case, we want to know, or the cop wants to know, given that someone's a minority, what's the chance that we should arrest them? That's the quantity on the left. And the arrest rate is the P of A on the right. And that the ratio in the middle there is given that someone is arrested, are they a minority, and then what's the minority population? And so if you plug in some numbers, very rough numbers, and I don't assume furtive movements because I don't know what furtive movements are, I'm assuming that just based on race alone, what's going on here? So if you say that New York City assumes that 87% of people that are arrested are minorities, and 50% is the minority population in New York City, which is blacks and Hispanics. And the general arrest rate is 5%. So given that you're a minority, should you be arrested is about 10%, which is twice the amount of the general population. And so if you're from the city, or a conservative blogger, which I've seen a few of them, saying, hey, there's 100% greater chance that a minority stop is justified over a random stop. You're like, wow, 100%, that's a lot. But then if you look at this probability, what's the probability that someone's a minority and should not be arrested? That number is 90%. And the general population, it's 95%. So my question then is, if it's not okay to stop and frisk 95% of the general population for nothing, then why is it okay to stop and frisk 90% of the minority population for nothing? And it's almost as if, like at the airport, you walk through and certain people get to go through without getting checked and other people have to get checked. That's a problem. So going to the national stage, this is back to our places, players, perils framework. And if you notice before, I ignored the NSA. Citizen surveillance. This is an important one because we are really grappling as a country with the trade-off between security and privacy. And security, and there's a lot of security people here I know, security is probably at least 10 years ahead of privacy. I think generally security is easy to formulate. It's really hard to execute well. But privacy is just, it's hard to even formulate. And so typically, security loses out, or privacy loses out to security. It's sort of like in the, you know, the old adage where, you know, with respect to breakfast, the pigs are committed, but the chickens are involved. Security is about commitment, and privacy is really about involvement. And that's why privacy typically loses out to security. However, I think that's potentially long-term disastrous. And this is a quote by Alex Howard, who's talks about data quite a bit, and I think he captured it pretty well when he said, we're being asked to trust without being able to verify. And I think that's a big issue around, as a democracy, how do we find the right balance point between security and privacy? And so President Obama is actually calling for more transparency in FISA courts and surveillance laws to be reviewed, which I think is great. I think we need more of that. It doesn't necessarily have to be the day that the FISA court rules, but soon after we should be able to know what actually was decided and why. This was really, though, kind of disturbing. The NSA chief announced plans to replace 1,000 system administrators with machines. If you know Ed Snowden, Edward Snowden was a system administrator. So I guess since he leaked this stuff, the obviously knee-jerk is get rid of everybody who has access to that and replace them with machines. I think that's a problem. And I think that if you look at sort of this pyramid of data leads to information, information, knowledge, knowledge leads to wisdom, we usually don't get to the wisdom part. We're very good at being enamored with our tools and our toys, but we usually don't think about how they can impact our society in a substantially profound way. And so you got these things like government doesn't trust people, but they trust machines. You don't have much transparency into what they're doing. And wisdom is hard to come by. And then you have the sentient brain in the cloud in less than 20 years, possibly. I don't want to be alarmist, but you know, I'm a little worried. You know, I mean, what are we walking ourselves into that might be hard to walk ourselves out of? Hillary Mason is the chief scientist at Bitly. I think she's the emeritus now. She has this great adage, which I think I really like, which is math plus code is awesome. And yes, it is really awesome, but it's not always awesome. Sometimes it's not so awesome. I think we realized in 2008 that math plus code was not so awesome, where we had financial weapons of mass destruction that almost brought down the world's economy. So, any good equation, can it be improved by a well-placed coefficient? Why don't we try to look at what are the values that we endow with our great technology and tools to make math plus code awesome? Because if the values are negative, it's powerfully negatively awesome. But if they're good values, then maybe they could really help things. The problem is that values are not very exact. They are often in conflict, like security and privacy, and security and liberty, and restraint and openness, and things like that. So we have to figure out how to get there from here. One last story. When I got out of school in December 85, I went to work for what's now Lockheed Martin. At the time, it was General Dynamics Space Systems in San Diego. And I was going to work on the space shuttle, and we're going to put our upper stage in the shuttle. So I show up for work January 27th, 1986. The next day, the shuttle blows up. And so we were on this government contract, so we were cooling our heels for about 6 months while they did the investigation into why this happened. And it turned out, as we all know, that the Rogers Commission was formed, and Richard Feynman, who I think all of you should know, Nobel laureate in physics, actually came out with the reason of why this happened. And it turns out it was a very cold Florida morning, and the O-rings lost their elasticity, and gas leaked, hot gas leaked, and punctured the main fuel tank. And so the funny thing is, Feynman really wasn't even supposed to be on the Rogers Commission, right? His wife actually convinced him to be on the commission. She said, you know, there's going to be 11 guys and women. I think Sally Ride was on there too. There's going to be 11 people in this knot running around from meeting to meeting, presentation to presentation. There's going to be one mosquito buzzing around looking for the answer, and that was Richard Feynman. And she turned out to be right, because William Rogers, Secretary of State, who ran the commission, at one point was quoted as saying, this Feynman guy is really driving me crazy. And yet he found the answer to this. And he wasn't an aviation expert. He was in the space industry. He's what I like to think of as an eclectic generalist. And eclectic generalists are these technologists that actually can endow the technology with the values of the culture. And Steve Jobs is famous for this, obviously. I love his quote from 1996. He says, the only problem with Microsoft is they just have no taste. And not in a small way. They have no taste in a big way. In that they don't think originally, and they don't endow their products with the values of the culture. And I think that's really important. If you look at Noriega, who was president of Sony in the 70s, he oversaw the development of the compact disc player. And he required that it had 74 minutes of audio on it. Why 74 minutes? Yeah, somebody knows his history. Beethoven's Ninth is 74 minutes. And he didn't want to change the CD. And so he drove the teams to get 74 minutes of audio on that CD. And I just love that story because it really shows that this cultural value of music and art was endowed into something that was critical for the age and something we rely upon now and have built on into what we take for granted now in music on demand. And you see that important dynamic over and over and over again. Because quite honestly, I would argue we are all making this stuff up as we go. Anyone who tells you different is either fooling you or fooling themselves. And I think there's sort of four stages that we go through. A friend of my son's drew this, Austin Alleman. You buy college kids beer, they will do anything for you. And I think there's this evolution of technology. You go from innocence, which is sort of denial, like there's no problem, and then you get this frontier stage. In privacy, certainly we were in this for a while, which is the just get over it, privacy's dead, promulgated by a lot of technology leaders. And then we often have this sort of over-rotation toward regulation. Like there's all these harms, we need to have regulation. And I think regulation is a very blunt instrument, and sometimes it's like scratching your back with a chainsaw. Yes, you'll get the itch, but there's a lot of collateral damage. And then you get to this innovation stage where I think you have smart regulation or smart policy connected to innovation. And so the question is really, how do you get there from here? And I would argue it's not how, but it's more who is important. And I've talked about geek suits and wonks for a while now, and I think those are the pillars of responsible innovation. I think if you have only two of the three, you don't really have what's necessary and sufficient to get to the right answer. I think if you look at, because we're all making this up as we go, there's this sort of Overton window that you must have tension on either side in order to find the right answer. So you have to have this push-pull, tug-of-war to find the right answer, because honestly, we're just kicking around in the dark and we really don't understand where we're going, and we need this dynamic of debate and experimentation to get there. Because I think this cycle is really important. I think we invent things, and then we question them and scrutinize them and criticize them. This crew clearly does that and embraces that, and I think that's really important. And then you need to do it again. Watch, listen, learn, and do it again. One of the objectives of Metanautics, the new company, is to really understand data flows and let companies understand the data they have and compute with it efficiently and easily, and I'm really excited about that because I think there's a lot of knowledge and wisdom out there that needs to be understood. So that's all I have. I really appreciate the attention. I think we have some time for questions, and I'd love to engage in a little bit of debate. Thanks.
I wanted to make a comment about your slide about, how much people know in our privacy. back in your Rockwell era, you were known, but by a very small number of people. And you could move somewhere else and no one would know anything about you. There's a difference between someone seeing your license plate in public and having databases of your license plate with GPS coordinates and times and photos. It's not quite just, oh, it's public. There's a lot more going on there.
I would agree with you. My point is the world is shrinking, and these data sets are shrinking it. And there is, we are going, my point is not that it's all, I'm not saying get over it. I'm saying that these technologies are shrinking the world, and we need to use the values that we had then of respect and empathy in order to live in a world where you just can't hide behind anonymity. And so, yes, there are certain abuses around access of data that we should curtail. Certainly health data and other kinds of data need to be protected. But when that data invariably gets out, how are we going to behave with it? How are we going to behave responsibly and respectfully and not abuse that information? I think we're headed down that road, and you just can't turn off all the data.
Yeah,
you have to act responsibly and respectfully.
Yeah, I recognize it's a big problem, but like for a regular person, how would you even know who's collecting information on you, let alone can you go there, opt out, correct, et cetera? How do you even know?
I think it's coming. One of the reasons we put out that TrueWrap product, so at least you could know. At least you can see what's out there. And there's actually a legislation in Congress now to give you access to the information about you that's publicly available and even privately available. And I'm a big supporter of that, because I think without transparency, we don't know what's going on. So I think once we know, then we could take appropriate steps of how do you control it, how do you correct it, how do you comment on it, how do you make sure the record is clear. Thanks. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Ulf Lindqvist with SRI. I really like this talk. I think it was great. I have lots of questions, but I'll try to stick to
sure.
just two.
Sure.
So one is a comment about the power disparity. You sort of hinted at it in the beginning when you talked about stalkers and victims kind of thing. I think it's important to recognize that power disparity, because as a law-abiding individual, you're kind of powerless against any crazy person out there. Mm-hmm. And actually, because of my work in security, I had a mentally unstable stalker for a while, and it was quite shocking to realize how easy they can find out where I live and
sure.
so forth. So that's one thing I think you should add to that equation. The other thing is whether consumers really have a choice today. Is there a 20-year-old who can choose not to be on Facebook, not have a cell phone, be off the grid and still have a social life? Is that really a choice?
I agree. I don't think it's a choice. And that's why I think we are in this realm of new policies to deal with that inescapable reality that you just can't get off the grid anymore. So how do you, to the lady's previous question, is how do you know what information's out there, and then how do you make sure that people act responsibly with it? That's the era that we're in. And I think there's going to be this reemergence of manners and empathy and better behaviors in order to deal with that reality.
Right, and per the previous lady's question, now your village is actually the world in that sense.
That's right,
so.
It is.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, hello, I'm Keith. I really enjoy your talk.
Sure.
So I just have one question for you. Do you believe that users have a right to view the profiles that you have created for them? And you know, should they be able to change what they think might be wrong about them?
Yeah, absolutely I do. That's one of the reasons why I talked about that product, that it gives you that transparency. So there's always two questions, and you nailed both of them, which is what information's out there, and then can I correct it? And the challenge with correction that we have today, which I think is a shame, is that a company like Intellia sits at the very end of the data supply chain. They're a retail, and there's this tremendous data-sucking machine that is the data supply chain upstream of that retail. And so what you really want to do is you really want to correct it at the headwaters of that supply chain, if at all possible. And that's not possible today, unfortunately. I think it's changing, and I think more and more public pressure around that will change. Because ultimately, if you look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which I think is important, because the Fair Credit Reporting Act, it was established in 1970, and it basically says if someone's going to use information for your livelihood, where you live, whether you can get a job or not, no matter where they get the data, they have to share with you whether there's any adverse information in it. And what that says is, and the reason they did that is because if your name is John Smith, the chance that you're a victim of mistaken identity is huge. And there's a lot of John Smiths out there that are criminals, and there's a bunch of John Smiths that are law-abiding citizens. And if someone pulls the wrong background check and decides not to hire you because of it, that's not fair if you're not that John Smith. And so accessing information, to the previous gentleman's point, is the world is shrinking and the data is available. We can't abuse it, though. And the FCRA says for really important survival kinds of contexts, housing, employment, insurance, you have to abide by these rules. How do we get there with these less vital uses of the data? That's the question I think that we as a society need to figure out. Yes, sir.
Joey Tyson, a privacy advocate who now works for Facebook, so I definitely enjoyed this talk. I have two kind of related questions. First would be, do you see, as we move forward, as the technology gets better and we have more and more information that is kind of being gathered or created about people, even indirectly now, as we start learning with like re-anonymization attacks where things can be inferred about you,
right,
will the value of transparency go down as the information about you out there just grows and grows with time?
Yeah, really good question. And that's why I ultimately have great faith in regulation or at least policy around abuse of the data itself. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where I got the data, whether it was inferred or not, or private or public, am I going to use that data against somebody for an abusive use, whether it be completely criminal, like stalking and other kinds of offenses that are harassment and those sorts of things, or might I use it in a very subtle way to discriminate? I know that insurance companies know who are bad. They know who are bad risks now. Are they using that to, like, based on social media data? They know who is a bad risk. I don't think they're at the point of using that data to allow or disallow policies, but when you call to cancel, they may fight you less if you're a bad risk. And so you start to see this sort of insidious use of this information, and are those uses all appropriate or not? So I think use-based policy is where we're going, because access-based policy is, you really can't, you don't know where the data came from. So there's it's going to be a growing problem, where a use base is very, although difficult, at least tractable, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you kind of answered, addressed the second question there, which was that, in security, we've said for a long time that security through obscurity is, right, is not a practical approach.
Right.
But I've been seeing a lot of people in the press more recently dealing with some of these privacy issues have been talking about the idea of privacy through obscurity. But again, it's one of those things where as the technology grows, that just seems to become less and less practical, even on the privacy
side. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a short-term thing. We'll just flood. There was companies out there that would just flood the net with stuff about you in order to cover up the other stuff. I don't know. That seems like an arms race to me.
Thanks.
Hi. Fabio Massacci from the University of Trento in Italy. So I like your comparison between Europe and the US. So there was something that probably you surely know. There's a big debate in Europe on the right to be forgotten. So I would really like to hear your opinion on this.
Yeah, that's a good one. I hate to plug my post, but I have a post on that that talks about the right to be forgotten. And the problem that I have with the right to be forgotten, it is really at the crux of this disclosure discretion debate. Because if you look at disclosure, close on the heels of disclosure is the right to an accurate history. And if you have a right to be forgotten, where is history going to go from there? And the example I like to use is the public Twitter fight. So I've been involved in some Twitter fights, and there's been a lot of Twitter fights out there. So the thought experiment I like to provide is, I'm in a Twitter fight with you. We both say things that we regret. And we both agree that, shouldn't we just like erase it? Because we both embarrass ourselves and, it's unfortunate. So we go to Twitter and we say, hey, erase that. I don't think that's right. And the reason I don't think it's right is because other people were watching the Twitter fight. And there's a public value to that. And they're going to take some lessons from that. Maybe good lessons, maybe bad lessons. But there's a public record there. And the fact that you should be able to erase public history, I think, is really dangerous. I think on the flip side, or the argument I often hear is, yeah, but the internet never forgets. Can't there be some tailing off of the historical record? And that's hard. I don't know where that is.
Let me just interrupt you one. I think problem is not really the tweets, but things is more, let's say, serious offense, like your criminal record, for instance, in particular, for instance, if you have been acquitted. I think at a certain point we had a problem with Google in Italy. One guy was first indicted or persecuted for something, and he was completely acquitted.
Right. So expungements of records should be possible. I agree. I agree with that. And there are certain circumstances, but I think the key words there are certain circumstances that warrant that kind of treatment. I mean, Intellius expunges records all the time, criminal records, and I think that's important. But I think they are very particularized to a certain class of them that are the most egregious, that really should have a shelf life. But I think when you say right to be forgotten, it could be interpreted very broadly, and then all of a sudden, you know, the internet is forgetting every 7 days. And obviously, you know, that's hyperbole, but you know, it's hard to find that balance. Yes, sir.
Scott Towsley with the science and tech part of DHS. Enjoyed the talk. It seems very Western-centric. You talked about implicitly things here in the U.S. and in Europe. It seems to me that we're headed down a slippery slope where this is, you know, social control capability. Have you thought about what Metanautics and your Chinese subsidiary is going to be doing with your technology in, say, 10 years to facilitate things and make people like Joseph Goebbels proud in terms of controlling everything that's going on in their society? Have you thought about that side of the equation?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, is your point that if you understand more of the information, that is therefore more easily exploit it? Is that a fair characterization of your question?
I was struck by the movie some years ago, The Lives of Others, which was an East European documentary that looked at citizens spying on themselves all across Eastern Germany, which was one of the ways that the country was so tightly controlled until it finally came apart. But some of these technologies, some of this stuff, when you look at it from the perspective of state-run societies that are interested in controlling all of their society, the implications are not particularly good.
Yeah, and I think when power disparity is large, the law must curtail those kinds of abuses. Now, in certain totalitarian societies, there's no law. And so, therefore, people need to keep their secrets in order to balance the power disparity. I absolutely believe that, of course. I mean, that's the only tool you have. I don't necessarily think that the way forward is to turn off the data, turn off the tools because of the abuses. I think it's important to deal head on with the abuses. I'm surprised no one's asked the Edward Snowden question yet. I'll wait for it. I think that, yes, you know, every tool can be used for good or for ill, and I think the law is often what prepares the society to get the most out of a technology. Yeah, and it could be abused. I think that we are running an experiment, but I don't think the way forward is backward. And maybe we disagree. Just agree to disagree.
Thank you very much. Excellent talk.
Thanks.
About a dozen years ago, there was a guy promoting big data before it became very popular. But basically, he said that the worst thing you can do at the time was, in terms of giving up who you are, was basically go to the same supermarket. At that time, A&P supermarket was very big. And basically, over a month, go in there and pay with your credit card. Because from that data, and they were getting about a terabyte of data from their cash registers every day. So basically, they knew how many toothpicks you bought, if you bought Pampers, all kinds of medical. So basically, they had a profile that was, obviously, it was internal, to their own data servers, but my question is that information shared and is that legal? In other words, when I go into a credit card and I buy something, is that legally doable today in terms of what I bought?
That's my legally, first. Is it legally shareable or can someone go buy that data set?
Correct. In other words, if I bought $100 worth of groceries and I bought everything from soup to nuts, my question is that information currently
on the market?
On the market sold?
No, it's not. At least, I mean, we were voracious buyers of information in Intellius. We never saw those data sets. I think those data sets, if they were made available, there would be a huge human cry against.
Well, that's
them.
What the guy mentioned. The point that he made from it, and this is going back a dozen years, is that he was saying is that if people knew how much information, because from it, what books did you buy at the supermarket? You know, or what political leanings you have, any kind of, you know, social interest you have or don't have. And not just that, they said, well, if Coke goes down by 10 cents, do you buy Pepsi?
Right.
I mean, sort of all this type of thing, which was, I mean, scared everybody. But that sort of follows up with, do you think that we're going to go to legislation? And I think what the prior questioner asked was that I am the owner of some pieces of digital data, whether it's my face, my search log, my public record, my non-public records that really don't need to be public. Do you see that really we need to define that? Because really at some point people can say, well, my DNA sequencing is my property, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I great set of questions. I think that the question, the nub of the question is what is private and what is public? And I think there needs to be, and there is right now, data that's private is generally private except when we give it away. And so supermarkets don't have the pain of sharing that information or selling that information is much, much greater than the gain. Online services, the equation is a little different. I would argue that your private online behavior is pretty private. And yet, we're giving it away in exchange for services all the time. And that worries me. Because I think that the supermarkets have, and the chains have, a much bigger vested interest in keeping your private information private, because it is so revealing, than some of the online services. And the problem that I have with the online services is really we as users of them, because we're like, hey, we love them, it's all free stuff, great, but it's not really free. And there's really no business model yet that's emerged that will allow me to pay for services with money instead of data. And I think that's a problem. And I've been saying it for the last 3 years. Facebook should add a charge me option. I think it's at odds with I think the current business model online with other online services. Don't mean to pick on Facebook at all, but many online services are free, but they're not free. And I think, unfortunately, people like to, they don't like the privacy violations, but they hate paying with their money more. And as I alluded to earlier, if you look at sort of the present cost of a future privacy disaster, it's zero for most people. The equation they do is like, well, in 20 years it's going to blow up in my face, but I really want to check out this new service online, and I'm going to do it. And so I think that dynamic has grabbed hold of us, and there hasn't been anything that has shaken it. I think the latest government trespasses have helped sensitize us to that a little bit. And maybe there'll be more drumbeat around that, because maybe we over-rotated toward openness and we're going to start to ratchet back toward defining private spaces in a more comprehensive way. Because I do think we're going to get there. Privacy is not dead. We're not going, this is a new technology. If any of you have read, Jeff Jarvis writes about this. He writes about Gutenberg in the press. And Gutenberg didn't even figure out, half a millennia ago, they didn't even know what the printing press was for until 50 years later after it was invented. We are, in year maybe 20 of the internet? And so we are figuring this out as we go. We need to have, ask tough questions of the services that we use and how we govern our lives. Anything else?
So if there are no more questions.
How about Snowden? Can I answer this briefly? Yeah, sure. As I alluded to, I think we're all, I don't want to speak for anyone. I'm a little mixed on Snowden. On the one hand, I feel like he clearly broke the law, but he clearly gave us some information we needed to have. And there's a great quote from Martin Luther King that, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but the gist of it is, the highest form of respect for the law is to break the law and then face your accusers. And he did the first part, but he didn't do the second part. And he would be much more of a hero if he did the second part and faced his accusers and came home. I do feel like we do need to have this national debate about the security privacy trade-offs we're making and where our society is going to be long-term, because it's important that for a democracy to work, we need to know what the people that are acting on our behalf are doing. And so he gave us a glimpse into what they're doing, and I think their hearts are in the right place, they're trying to protect us, but it's a slippery slope to totalitarianism, like the gentleman here brought up. And the only way democracy, I think, operates efficiently is education and transparency and then debate. Thanks, everybody.
Yep, really send the speaker it. Again, please.